Today, we are going to talk about the teaching job interview. Those of us who have taught have all been through it many, many times, probably several times at least. And it's often difficult to anticipate what's going to happen. Oh, there are certain questions, like how do you deal with discipline? What do you do? How are you going to do this in the classroom? And what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? All this thing. But we thought it might be a good idea to go through the whole continuum in the education system and talk about what administrators are looking for in the interviewees. So our first panelist will be Mr. John Davis. He is the director of the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind, MSAB. He started at MSAB in 1999 and has served as the director since 2009. Before becoming the director at MSAB, he taught science, coached many sports, served as the athletic director, and served as the president of the North Central Association of Schools for the Blind while he was the MSAB athletic director. So without any further introduction or further ado, I would like to bring on Mr. John Davis.
Thank you, Carla. Hi, I'll give you a little bit of history about our school here in Minnesota. This is our 150th year as a school. We're a state agency, so our hiring process is a little bit different than what you'd find in a typical school district. You have to go through the whole state HR program even to get to where we're getting your resume and application. We serve birth through 21. We have typically between 50 to 60 kids on campus, and we serve another 45 kids in outreach. About 30 of them stay on the campus through the week, and the rest are day students. They're from districts from the kind of the around the cities and the south central part of the state, so they travel back and forth every day. Now, I've had to hire several teachers, and you know, with the job interview, it begins before I even actually talk to you. It begins when I get the resume and the letter. You know, and there are many times I've gotten letters or resumes that the way they're written, whether they're well presented, grammatically correct, the resume highlights does a good job of highlighting your skill set and your background. If that's not there, I'm not probably going to invite you to an interview. That's the first thing. So once we get the resume and letter in, we'll set up an interview. It's typically what we do is we do a kind of a round-robin interview with other staff members from our school. They each individually ask one of the questions, and then at the end of the interview, we'll get together and we'll discuss a little bit and kind of rank the prospective teacher. What we're looking for, you know, right up front is that presentation. Are you presenting yourself as a professional? That's showing us that you have some commitment and you are very interested in the job, that you have done research on our school, you come prepared. We're looking for that. There are many instances where we've had prospective teachers show up, and it's quite obvious that they've not done a single lick of research on our school. They have no idea what our school's about, who we're serving, and they show up in shorts, t-shirt, that kind of stuff. You know, you get those kind of interviewees, that's pretty much the end of the interview for us. We'll go through the process, because it's always good for people to go through that process, but that's showing us that you're not interested in what we're doing and our students. A typical interview, we're going to run probably between 13 and 15 questions. You have the typical questions for teachers, but we, because we're a special ed site, tend to focus on some of the special ed questions to see what people, we understand that people may not have the background in special ed, but we want to see if they even have an idea, because one of the things that we face is a shortage in TBVIs. So a lot of our prospective teachers are coming to us with licensure in other areas, and part of our requirement once they get there is to go back and get that licensure for TBVI. So we'll ask questions such as, let's see, it's very important in the school with special ed students. Have you had experience working with paraprofessionals? What do you believe to be the role of a paraprofessional? As a teacher in a setting like ours, that's going to make or break a teacher, how you deal with those paraprofessionals. So that's a very important question. We also ask questions like, have you had experience working with related services? Even if you just show that you understand what a related service is, such as occupational therapy, speech, we're going to be more interested than somebody that has no clue as to what that is. Have you had experience serving as a case manager? Do you know what? Can you go through and explain what an IEP is? And then one of the primary, another big area we ask is, because a lot of our school is about building and maintaining the relationship not only with their students but with their parents, is how do you believe your role is in working with, what do you believe your role is in working with the parents, and how do you communicate and how do you maintain that relationship? And that's particular to our school. It's really particular for our school because we're a small school, so we need to have that good relationship with the teachers to ensure that we're going to have that continuing enrollment at our school. Not something you may typically find in a large school district. They may give you a cursory question as to that, but that's not going to be a big focus for them. And then we're going to ask, we're not going to get somebody who has the TBVI licensure. If we do, that's great. But we're going to ask them if they're willing to go back and do the training. Now, when you're going into that interview, one of the things, especially if you're coming from an out-of-state site, and I think this will be true for any state you go into, you need to have a good idea what those requirements are going to be, because that may affect your choice in actually applying to that for that job. If you have a TBVI, and for instance in our state, they're going to have a whole host of other requirements for you to go through before you can get your teaching licensure. We can put you on what we call a variance, so you can have time to do that. But you're going to want to be aware that this may be 1 or 2 years of further education that you're going to be required to do to get the licensure within the state you're looking at. If you're coming in with a TBVI, one of the things that we're interested in the other way, because we're a school, is we want people that have licensure in other areas. Like, I believe the person here from Wisconsin has your fax licensure, or a licensure in math, science, because we're also responsible as an educational institution to provide, you know, those licensed teachers in those areas. Okay. At this point, is there any questions that you may have? Yes?
I have two. One is, we had gone yesterday to another educational seminar, and they had suggested between the resume and the letter that we should be on LinkedIn. Lisa, you did not mention that you go there, so I'm just wondering what your thought is on that.
Minnesota's unique in how they approach teaching and teaching licensure. A lot of where we go to is they have the state kind of pool of candidates, and that's where we get a lot of our candidates, where we'll put out our announcement for position and where a lot of our candidates come from. I think LinkedIn is maybe I think it's more a good resource for the people that are the teachers that are looking for jobs, so they can connect to other professionals and maybe get support that way. As an administrator, my time is pretty well taken up by a lot of stuff. And the last thing I have is time to go look at LinkedIn. You know, that's why getting that resume and that letter, if you have a link on there to LinkedIn, I may go look at that.
So you would mention it on your letter?
Yeah. Or if you have another website or you know, some other a social media site that would be good for me to look at, I'm not going to, as an administrator, I'm not spending a lot of time on LinkedIn.
Okay.
My time is pretty well accounted for all kinds of other things. It's a good resource for me, for any administrator, if you put it on your resume or in your letter, for me to go and do some looking to see if there's, you know, some of the other background, and help me differentiate between candidates that are very close.
Second question was attire. I'm an early childhood teacher.
Yep.
When I was in business, I always wore my suit and, you know, everything perfect. But as an early childhood teacher, the place that I had gone to interview with wanted us in slacks and something that you would actually wear when you were in the classroom, but professional.
Right. Yeah.
What do you suggest with women attire, women's attire?
That's very appropriate.
Pants are okay.
Pants suit, something that it's professional.
Okay.
You know, that you take pride in how you look and how you're presenting yourself to others. It really shuts people down when you get somebody coming in and they don't have enough care for how they're looking. It tells you something about what they're going to be like in the classroom. Whether that's fair or not, it does. Have any other questions?
The resumes that you see that are coming in, are they in all different styles, you know, different formats?
Yes.
And the reason I say this is because, you know, I graduated from college 24 years ago, and at that point there was a teaching resume. This is how you filled it out if you were going to be a teacher. So what is the recommended style, or what do you suggest on a resume, how to put it together?
I suggest that, you know, for me in particular, I actually read the letters, because the letters give me some good information about how you put things together, how you process information, how you present yourself. It highlights some of your accomplishments. On the resume, I like to see those highlights. Like, boom, you know, here's my education. Boom, boom, boom. Here's where I've taught. This is, you know, some of the other accomplishments I've had. And I would prefer like a 1 or 2 page, you know, probably a 2 page resume. You know, I get 3 or 4 page resumes, and then I'm starting to think maybe they're padding.
So you brought up the letter.
Yep.
How much detail do you want in the letter?
Enough to let me know that you've done some research, that you've looked at maybe our website or, you know, or Facebook and stuff, and there you got some information. Oh, I see, you know, you have a very active transition program, and I, you know, an important part of that is for those students to learn home living skills, and this is what I can bring to that. And this is, you know, this is my background, and I'm very, you know, that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have another question.
Yep.
Yesterday when we were talking, they were saying that you definitely don't want to go into an interview without them knowing that you have a disability, especially when you have a disability that is not visible. When do you suggest you bring that up?
And, you know, for our school, that's not such an issue. You know, we're considered a special ed site, and we have staff that have disabilities. It's not really a big thing for us.
So
now, if you're going into maybe a large district, that's probably something that you want to be very upfront about, because that's going to tell them your needs as a staff person, you know, what are the accommodations that you're going to need, and you know, you're just being honest.
So do you put that
the last thing you want to be is kind of not really you know, because then they're gonna find out at some point, and that's right, and that's gonna be a huge mark against you if you're not just upfront here, you know.
So where do you think, you know, it shouldn't be in your resume, but it could be. I mean, I've been using my dog and cane for a long time. Should it be in the letter?
It could be in the letter. It could be like in the last, you know, last paragraph, just, you know, in my. Maybe you're saying a statement about in my past teaching jobs, I've had to bring my, I brought my dog. Would that be an issue at your site? That kind of stuff.
Okay. Thank you. Can I just interject that I've done it both ways, and I have found that administrators do not like surprises.
Yeah.
There have been times that I've not disclosed in any shape and form, and I've gotten there and I've gotten a 15-minute polite interview and nothing more. On the other hand, there are ways in the letter that, you know, I've mentioned that, and they read between the lines, they see that I attended the School for the Blind too, but in the letter I say something like that, although I am blind, you know, I have learned to deal positively with this, and I've even said things like it even gives me more of an empathy and an understanding of children with disabilities.
Yeah, highlight the positive.
Yes.
And highlight how you've dealt with it, and that it's not, you know, it's not a big deal. It's just something that you need to deal with. It's just part of work process. And I would agree. As an administrator, the last thing I want is a surprise in any part. You know, and show up to a meeting, show up to an interview, and then I'm just going to go, yeah.
So you guys don't,
they weren't very honest with me. I'll be polite and I'll do the interview, but.
So you do not do phone interviews then before the interview?
Typically not. And that's more because we don't get a lot of response. We get smaller amounts of response. So usually, you know, unless there's something just kind of standing out that we're kind of questioning, we'll invite most of the people that will apply to the job to come, at least to give an interview. Because you never know who you're going to get. You know, people write very nice resumes, but then they get into an interview and they struggle, or they write a, you know, a good letter, you know, a kind of a good resume, but it doesn't really stand out. But once they get into the interview, they're really good at explaining how they teach, what they do in the classroom, you know, showing that they care for the kids.
I think that's a very interesting discussion, because when I was applying for jobs, I never disclosed that, and, you know, I never mentioned it. And my philosophy was always that meeting me and, you know, meeting my personality and, you know, and by the end of the interview, because I know employers are not allowed to ask how you're going to do the job, correct?
Right.
So by the end of the interview, then, you know, when they would ask me if there was anything that I wanted to say, then I would say, well, you might be wondering, you know, how I plan to do the job, not being able to see, you know, these are my plans, this is what I do, so on and so forth. So I wonder, has there been any research done about, well, I mean, I guess it'd be hard to do that, you know, how many letters just get thrown in the garbage as soon as they see that there's a disability. I mean, especially school districts, they don't have a ton of money to spend, and as soon as they see somebody with a disability and they think, oh, adaptive technology, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, in my situation, it's not a big deal because
right.
we're a school for the blind, and it's just, it is an issue out there, but I think it's better to be honest and upfront than to surprise somebody, because if you're not and you just surprise them, they're pretty much going to shut you. They'll be polite, but that'll be the extent of where that goes. Because your job in the interview is to sell yourself and make it so that they can't not hire you, even though you may have needs for other accommodations. But they want you. They want your skills. Any other questions? Seen other questions? Oh, one here.
I do have one. And actually, feel free to take the gloves off and be perfectly honest about this one. I had thought about going into elementary ed and then decided I'd rather work with adults. But when I was doing a tutoring program, they wanted to know, you know, and the person, it wasn't a job interview, so she could ask me about classroom management or how would I work with my students to make sure they were doing what they were supposed to be doing and so forth and so on. How do administrators deal with those type of classroom management issues when you can't, as an employer, ask how somebody's going to do the job? That might be.
You can ask how you're. That's where I'm going to be interested in how you work with the kids. You know, what kind of how do you set up a lesson? How do you communicate with the parents? It's really hard to get, until you actually observe somebody in the classroom,
uh-huh.
It's pretty hard to determine how they're going to be. With classroom management, one of the things you can do to overcome that is be pretty strong and assertive in the interview. Because if you come in and you're kind of meek and holding back, then I'm going to have some questions about, and it doesn't matter whether you're a sighted person or not, I'm going to have questions. Boy, how are they going to do with the classroom of kids?
So then that's really where a young blind teacher, any blind teacher, could really use that then as an opportunity to allay
right.
apprehensions of an administrator, and the way they answer those types of questions.
Yeah, and knowing that that's probably a question out there that to come in with, I really love it when they come in with examples of what they've done in classrooms and highlight, you know, how they worked with students. You know, we'll have a question in there probably about, okay, you have a disruptive student, or tell me about a disruptive student in your one of your past classes, and how did you deal with that? And that's kind of how you get around that classroom management question.
Now, do you like to see a portfolio that a teacher might bring in that shows a typical unit, including lesson plans, learning activities, and things that the teacher did or would do when teaching that unit? I found that one of the principals I did that for was very impressed with that.
Yes, I like to see that. I like to see examples of what, really examples of what you've already done. And if it's a teacher that's an experienced teacher coming in, or if you're just fresh out of college, but you've had, you know, you've done student teaching, so you can bring in some stuff that you've done in the classroom with kids.
The new portfolios ask you to do a video. Would a video be a good idea, or you wouldn't have to take the time to look at?
A video is fine. What you probably want to do would be to have it on some type of website. You know, in the last 5 years, I went through my specialist degree, and we had to do a portfolio as an administrator of all our skill sets. And typically it's a website, and you load up all those examples in there. And they do the same thing for teachers. And then you give me that link so I could go and look.
I'm going to ask a question, and I hate to do this. I'd never like to get people off the subject, but I'm going to do it. because maybe this would give you some insight into interviewing, too. I don't think any principal that, you know, talked to the group has talked about what are you really looking for in a classroom observation. I know this is a little further down the line past the interview, but I think that could help especially inexperienced teachers to prepare.
What I'm looking for is students engaged in what's going on. There's active learning going on. And there's consistent feedback from the teacher to the students as to how they're doing. Now, you may not see that in one instance of observation, but you do. What I like to do in my school is I walk around and I just drop in and I see, and I get that kind of you get that constant input, and you see how things are going. And it's pretty obvious if you walk by and drop into the classroom, the kids are kind of running around and it just looks like a big social group that there's not a lot of step education going on in there, whereas you go into there, they may be separated, but they're all active, they're all engaged in what they're doing, the teachers providing feedback. That's what I like to see. I also like to see that they, you know, it's an intangible, but you can see that teacher cares about the kids. That's the most important thing for them at that time in the classroom, is to make sure that they're engaged. Those kids are the number one purpose for them being there. So
that is very insightful, because some, in my experience, some administrators are sort of, you know what they're looking for, but some of them are very subjective and wishy-washy, not only with their observations, but also with their interviewing techniques and their interview questions. So if you were to give people that are looking for teaching jobs, one piece of advice that is the most important thing that would be a takeaway for preparing for a job interview, what do you think that would be?
I think one, well, I'll kind of interrupt, but really an important thing is to do your research on where you're applying for. What is that school about? And that's also going to tell you as a prospective teacher, maybe this school is not a good match. And you can pick that up. And that's probably my, because that as an administrator, that impresses me, and it tells me a lot about the teacher. When you're talking about your assessment, I come from the view that teachers are not all alike. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. But ultimately, what am I looking for? I'm looking for the students to be learning and engaged, and then the teacher to be providing that feedback to the students. I'm not going to tick off, they've done this, because that still doesn't tell me whether the kids are learning or not. It tells me that they went to school, they took the classes, they can prepare a really great-looking lesson plan, but a lesson plan is just a lesson plan unless, if you're not engaging the kids, it's not going to do much. You need to get to those kids. Yeah.
Since you're an administrator, I wonder what, under the law, under the ADA, what kind of accommodations can you offer or would you offer or not even offer, give to, like a teacher with a visual impairment or blind? What's reasonable?
That's kind of an amorphous thing. What's reasonable is what allows that person to be able to do their job. Whether that's providing somebody to, one of the things that we run into are a lot of the programs out there for teaching, a lot of the data programs, the IEP programs are not very accessible. So my viewpoint is we will, to be able to allow those teachers to do their job, and we have teachers that are visually impaired, we will have, somebody help them go through the process where they need the help and let them direct what help they need. If we have a teacher at TBVI that's doing outreach, certainly one of our accommodations is going to be able to provide transportation to and from those sites. If we have a tech specialist that does a lot of outreach, goes to a lot of conferences and stuff, we provide the transportation to and from. So, whatever is needed, that's for them to do their job.
How do you feel about the use of classroom aids for a teacher who is blind or visually impaired? Is it something that you encourage or that would go against the teacher?
As far as for something like assistance with, what we've done with, like, accessing the programs for the IEP and being able to get the stuff in, we've done that. If you're talking about classroom management, well, that's the teacher's job. That really shouldn't be the paraprofessional that's in there.
Okay. monitoring tests.
Monitoring tests we've done. You know, things that are not, that I wouldn't, that are kind of maybe day-to-day incidental stuff, you know, like monitoring tests, assisting the teacher, putting stuff into a program, that kind of stuff. If we have a teacher aide in the classroom, and we've had teacher aides in the past, but they've been kind of general elementary teacher aide where they help do classroom or preparation of classroom materials, that's certainly applicable. But if you're talking about anything that's directly to the teaching or the classroom management, things that I would consider a responsibility of the teacher, that really, that's the teacher to do that. It should be doing that.
Do you think it goes against a teaching candidate, especially going into a school district, if the expectation is that they might need an aide? Or have the trends changed, because a lot of regular sighted teachers use aides and lay readers and paraprofessionals in their classrooms to help out because of the larger class sizes and the students with different disabilities?
And that's where as a candidate, your research into that district is important, because it's going to vary from district to district. In Minnesota, there are good districts out there that'll provide that, and then there are districts that are just kind of riding on the edge monetarily, mm-hmm. and they just don't have the funding to do it. So that's where, as a prospective teacher, you need to be doing your research. And you know, if you're looking at a district that's kind of has some monetary issues, and you're, that's where you're going to really want to highlight your why they need to hire you to overcome some of the questions they're going to have and you know, issues they're going to have with, can they support that?
I'll just add on to that from personal experience. When I was hired, they asked me if I wanted a classroom assistant, and since I was just coming out of college and I was independent and I was going to do everything on my own and I didn't need anyone else's help, I said no thanks, but you know, can we just keep that request open, and if I see that I need one, I can come back. Well, I came back in 2 or 3 months and asked for one, and they said, oh no, we never offered you that. And if you can't provide, if you can't do these tasks, then you're not fulfilling, you know, your tasks as a teacher. So sometimes I think, I mean, now I know if I get offered something, it's much better to say yes and then go back and say, I really don't need that anymore. So that was my experience.
I have a question. Yep. In regards to, I guess, a private school or even public school. When I'm legally blind and have some sight left, but they don't understand what I can see. Some people don't seem to want to believe you as to what you can see, which is a negative of them not wanting to hire you.
Right.
How do you suggest to overcome that?
Boy, you're going to have to be very proactive in explaining to them what you're seeing and not seeing. And, you know, that may be offering to provide them some, you know, blindness training, get some of those goggles, deals that show that reduce the field of vision. And, you know, say, you know, I just want you to understand what I'm seeing, so we'll do this, and now you get an idea what you're dealing with and why you need the accommodations.
also give references, maybe.
Yeah.
Have written references from where I'm already presently working.
Yes.
That show examples of how I have adapted my for my vision loss.
Yeah, references are good, but just understand that when I call a reference, they really can't tell me much of anything.
Yeah, but if you get
other
a
than
one,
what they are you again or not.
But if you get a written reference?
A written reference is good.
Okay.
A letter is nice.
Okay.
Especially if it goes to you know, it'll address a certain issue that how you've done that. But as I said, it, you know, giving me references, is good, but there's only so much they can tell me.
Right.
But just to let you know, there are certain ways that we can let other people know that, oh, yeah, probably want to pass on this person. Or, hey, no, great hire. You really definitely want this person.
So I have, like, a reference from a parent that I used to take care of their child. And he highly recommended and gave examples and things like that. And if you need any further information, please give me a call.
Right.
Would you call them if
yeah.
you had any other questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
So most people would call them.
Most people are going to call. It's just good HR process.
Okay.
You have to do those reference checkups just to even verify, just to verify that, yeah, that's a person
right.
and they know you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess the moral to the story is you have to be careful whom you choose to be your references. And you have to have confidence, too.
Yeah, yeah. And always, you know, ask them. You know, you may have asked them a year ago and you still have them on the list. Check back with them. Say, hey, I'm going to be applying for jobs. I have you on my reference list. Know that you might be getting some calls.
Carla? This is Susan. I would add to being careful, just being selective, because a reference for one particular position for which you're applying might not be as appropriate as one
yeah.
for another.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Do we have any more questions? You probably feel like you're in. This
no,
is
that's
not
fine.
The Spanish Inquisition.
That's fine.
But this is one of the most meaningful workshops that I think we've had in a long time, and I really appreciate you being so candid and straightforward.
Yeah, no, that's quite all right.
Does yeah. anybody have any further questions?
Okay.
At the end, there may be more because
okay.
we'll have our second panelist
yeah.
as well. I think this is really great that you folks, I think this is really great. And I wanted to reiterate, we need to have presentations like this. We need to have conversations with this, like this, dialogues with people that are in the know. We really do. And I think this has been a golden opportunity, and I think it's given us a lot of food for thought. And so I'm really glad that we were able to do this. Well, okay, we've talked about the hiring process from the standpoint of schools, and now we're going to graduate, pardon the pun, to what happens in when hiring for college, university. It's a little bit of a different let's say orientation. So to that end, I would like to bring up a dear friend of mine, and that is Susan Glass. Now, Susan Glass is a retired English professor, and she's from West Valley Community College. That's where she worked, in Saratoga, California. And she has been on search committees for faculty positions. And the process will have certain things in common with looking for a school teacher, but certain things that are probably very different.
So let's hear now from Susan Glass.
Carla is correct. I taught at the college and university level, taught English for 30 years. I began teaching at San Jose State University in California in 1983. I did teaching work when I was earning my master's degree at the University of Massachusetts as well. But I began teaching on a full-time basis in 1983, and I retired in 2013. And over the course of that career, and I say this not at all to blow my horn, but to set a context for everything I'm going to say, during the course of that career, I taught courses in English composition, American comparative literature, women's studies, women in the arts, creative writing, technical writing, upper division composition, critical thinking, modern fiction. There was quite a range of coursework by virtue of the Master's of Fine Arts degree that I had, as did my colleagues. It wasn't just me. We were all teaching this curriculum. I also, in the course of my teaching career, especially when I moved on to West Valley Community College, where I became a full professor, I served on a number of hiring committees, some for colleagues in the English department, but some other committees as well, because when we staff our search committees, we try to be interdisciplinary in nature. And so what we usually do is we have instructors from the field of study, biology, English, but then we also add someone from another discipline, as well as someone from student services, as well as a student on each committee. And so I was on the hiring committee for our director of disability services. I was on a hiring committee for someone we hired in the reading department and for someone that we hired in the English as second language department, as well as hiring committees in my own department. And I tell you those things because I've come to this process from the green would-be just out of school, oh my goodness, I need to make a living, how do I do this, side of that fence. And then I've been on the other side of it, you know, where we're actually screening candidates and making those calls to references. I was also English department chair for 4 years at West Valley Community College. And I was also part of some state initiatives, such as the State Student Success Program, Puente, which is Spanish for bridge. It's a special success program for Latino students, and also an interdisciplinary studies consortium, which is where we try to create curriculum that crosses the disciplines. So you're teaching math courses that have a language arts component, or biology courses that have a humanities component, and so on. So that's my background. That's what I bring to this conversation today. My approach, there are some wonderful overlaps. It was so neat to hear John talk about how the interviewing committees are staffed and what people are looking for and what happens with references and reference check, and also in classroom evaluation settings and instructor survey. There are some crossovers here, so I will be able to tie that together. My portion of our conversation is less about administrators, since at the college level where I taught for 30 years, administrator interviews are the tier who interview you after you have already been interviewed by your search committee for your department. So in other words, the way it works is a job announcement goes out for a Department of English who's looking for a specialist who can teach technical writing and has grounding in basic skills. The candidates apply. They are interviewed by the search committee that I just described to you. Two or three finalists are recommended, and then the administrators take you through the second round of interviews, so that means you are then interviewed by the president of your college or the dean of instruction or both. The administrator vision is less about you and your teaching practice in your classroom, though that certainly matters. It is less about that because the administrator assumes that your screening committee at your college department level took care of, you know, has found you satisfactory in those regards. So the administrator's vision is less about you and more about the institution, such as the college or university where you're teaching, as a whole, and whether or not your teaching style and your teaching philosophy meshes with that of the institution. Does that make sense? So they're going to be asking you a broader base range of questions. And it's the people at your department level who have made that gateway interview for you. And then if you're a finalist, you have the secondary interview. So they are the folks that you will convince first that you know your subject area, your students, that you are capable of delivering course content and teaching effectively and working collegially, and that you can do those things with your blindness. Those are the people you impress first, and then you impress your administrators. Today I'm going to give an overview of my own career, but do it in a way to highlight each of these areas that I've just spoken about. And I'm going to try to tie each story that I tell you in with a teaching tip or a job search tip or an employment tip. And the first tip that I would offer is to be proactive in your job search. And that ties in with what John Davis said about doing your research. I graduated from the University of Massachusetts Amherst with my master's in May of 1983, but I've actually returned home to California in January of that year because I had completed my coursework and I was going to go back and defend my thesis. And so I got back to California and I had 5 months in front of me and I said, I'm too squirrely to just sit here. I really need to start looking now. And the hiring process at the college level works this way. If you can demonstrate that you will have the degree and diploma in hand by the start of your teaching position, they will interview you. And so what I immediately began to do with a lot of help from family and supportive friends was to look around at the universities and community colleges in my area, go to the libraries, research them, the history of the campuses, the history of the curriculum, the English departments then in power, you know, who were the chairs of the departments, what were their specialties, and so on. And there was no internet, you know, because this was 1983, so I did this by walking into libraries and picking up college catalogs and studying with my reader and taking notes and that sort of thing. And I was a little bit, how do I say this? I was a little bit, I'm looking for a word that I can't find. I did things that were a little bit unorthodox. I did actually apply for jobs and go in for interviews, but I actually showed up on campuses unannounced and walked into English departments carrying my dossier and just said, hi, I was Susan Bailey at the time was my maiden name. I'm Susan Bailey and I'm looking for work and I just graduated from UMass Amherst. Just wondering what jobs might be available here. And it was kind of cool because I met people who are your very best friends often, office managers, people who are running the scheduling and all of that, and one of them is still my buddy, Mark Busman, from San Jose State University from 30 years ago. And you might think that was a little bit chutzpah, but it actually worked because the first place I went was San Jose State University, and it just happened that the department chair, Dr. John Gaum, was in that day. And Mark and I had a really good conversation, and Mark said, hold on a minute. And he went in the next room, and he came back and got me, and he said, Dr. Gaum wants to meet you. And I had this really nice conversation with a man who was in his late 50s, who taught Old and Middle English, had very left-leaning politics like me, so there was some really cool stuff going on right away. But the upshot of that was we talked about where I just graduated from. We talked about schools around the country. He looked at my dossier, and he said, well, we're scheduling interviewers for our part-timers starting next week. Let's get you on the calendar. And so I left his office that day with an interview as a part-time faculty member that I came back 2 weeks later. And he was in the room, and there were three or four other people in the room. And you can bet I had done more San Jose State research before I came back. And they asked questions because I was a part-timer and they knew I was brand new. They don't ask you as many things about your teaching, but he said, well, what teaching have you done? And I told him about the graduate work at the university. he asked if I had any publications. Well, I had had a publication. I had an article published in an in-house on-campus magazine about teaching practice, and I had that. I pulled that out and shared it. He asked what courses I would like to teach and how much I would be willing to work. And in the course of that conversation, I had showed up with my cane, and I just started talking about how I taught at UMass and how I would have students tape record essays and pronounce their punctuation, and how I would listen to those essays and then work with a reader to write comments on the paper. And I kind of worked it in to the conversation without being asked. And the good news was that he called about a week later and said, we'd like to offer you part-time work in the fall. And part-time work was 3 comp classes, heaven help me, with 33 students in each class. And so I said, wow, this is wonderful, thank you so much. And I hung up, and then I got really, 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 really scared. But that was kind of how that happened. My other tip, by the way, besides being diligent and being proactive and do your research, is be willing to work pro bono at least initially, just till you get in your foot in the door. And the reason I want to tell you that is that before I had talked to Dr. Gulm, I had also gone over to a local community college near us, and the English chair's name was Linda Kitts, and I introduced myself, and I asked her about her hiring process, and she explained, and I told her about my degree coming in hand, and she said, well, you know, we don't have any positions right now, but our writing lab, where we tutor students, is really understaffed. Would you be willing to tutor? And I said, yes, 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 yes. And that was to my advantage, because I later did work at that college. But also, I did not want to be out of the classroom between January and September, did I? I mean, I needed to be doing something. So I tutored pro bono at that college, and I got to know a lot of students and a lot of faculty that way. And it was really, really a neat experience to have that happen. I think I've already said a little bit about doing your homework and doing your background research and demonstrating during your interview that you have taken time to learn about the institution where you're going to work. I think I'll jump ahead a little bit. I won't. I'm going to pause at San Jose State University for just a moment and tell a challenge story, because we all have them. And I don't tell this to whine or engage in sour grapes. I tell it because it happened and because it's something just to think about. I joined the faculty at San Jose State in the fall of 1983, started teaching my 3 classes, and about 6 weeks into the semester, I was evaluated by 2 colleagues, which always happens at the college level. You have classroom visitations. And the evaluation went just fine. There were 2 colleagues. They came in, they watched me teach, they wrote up some notes, they called me in, we talked it over. We talked about grading, we talked about some different ways of doing things. And then about a week and a half later, Dr. Gulm, my good friend, called me back into his office, and he said, I feel really awful about this, but I need to give you a second collegial evaluation. And I got scared. I said, did I do something wrong that Dr. Lewandowski or Dr. Rico didn't tell me? He said, no, no, no. He said, I can't tell you who, but there is a senior faculty member here who has raised questions about your ability to teach. And then he said, I quote, I'm going to cover your ass. That's what he said. And I wanted to know who it was, but I knew that it wasn't professional to inquire. And so it was a very frightening 4 or 5 weeks, because I was everywhere I was going, and, you know, to the copy machine, to the library, to the writing lab, and everyone I was talking with, there was a little voice in my head saying, is it you? Is it you? Is it you? It can't be you. It can't be you. I don't think, tip my hand. This time, Dr. Gulm himself came to my class and evaluated it. He brought with him the chair of the rhetoric department, Dr. Hans Guth. They took extensive notes. They backed up what Lou Lewandowski and Dr. Rico had put in their evaluations. And at the top of the file, Dr. Gulm wrote, this second evaluation was given because a member of this faculty had the audacity to inquire about someone's qualifications, and we wanted in writing that she needs to be here. And I'm telling you that story not to blow my own horn. There are some really good people out there in the world, and they will go to bat for you. And later, when I was a department chair, it became necessary for me to go to bat for someone who was in really serious trouble and didn't deserve to be. That's another story for another day. But those are the kind of lessons, you know, that you learn along the way. So that story had a good ending. And, you know, what I learned from it is that when that happens, you need to do your job, you need to comport yourself with grace, and you need to have your emotional meltdown at home, because that's the only way to get through. I taught at San Jose State for 14 years as what was then called a part-timer, three courses a term. I also taught at Santa Clara University, which was a private school. The day that I got the interview with Dr. Galm, I got enough guts up to go over and drop a resume off at Santa Clara and then called them back a couple years later, so I got to work there a little bit. I taught at Intel Corporation in the Business Institute, English language for people who wanted to be, they wanted to climb to management positions and their English skills were not proficient. And then finally, the part of my career I really loved were the 16 years at West Valley Community College, where I taught full time. And do I have a couple more minutes, Carla? What do you think? It's 2:29.
Yes, why don't you take a couple minutes and a couple of questions?
Okay.
We'll take a short break before our next session.
Okay.
I think this is all very.
So I will wrap this up really quickly. I will just tell you about the interview at the community college and how that works and the kinds of things that I learned from that. So when you interview for a community college position, the way it works, at least in the colleges I've interviewed at, is that when you are called for interview, they send you a packet of material, and basically that interview consists of you showing up 30 minutes ahead of time to receive a paper which you must grade, guide the student panelist on your interview committee through a conference in which you discuss that paper and how you're grading it, how you're marking it, talk to the people on the panel about how you're doing it. They also give you a lesson to teach, and my first time around, it was a set of readings, and they were all on African-American and Latino curriculum, and they said, prepare a discussion class and a writing assignment for an English 1B course using these readings. And so you had to do all that, you know, before you came. And so I did, and I showed up, and each person, there was the teaching demonstration, and one of the ways that I addressed the accommodation issue there was I wanted to give everybody on that committee handouts, so I had printed them, and then I put each group of handouts into a separate folder, and I put a Braille label on the folder so I'd know, okay, I'm giving you a copy of the reading, I'm giving this envelope or the discussion questions, this envelope is the the essay assignment. And then as I gave it out to the people on my interview committee, I said, now, if my organization system has served me all right, you should be now receiving the syllabus, now you should be receiving, and I could check back. And that's important because that's how I'm going to be doing it with my students too, right? When it's time to hand things out in the classroom, you know, you're saying, okay, I need somebody to help me distribute this, let me just check this out with you, this is what we're, you know, what I'm giving out. And I brought the talking laptop with JAWS and pulled up some things just deliberately so they could, you know, they could see that happening. And then that committee asks you all kinds of questions. You know, describe an assignment that was successful. Describe the assignment that failed and what you did about it. Describe the most challenging experience you've ever had working with students. Talk to us about adult learning theory was one I got one year. You know, and one of my tips is to try to anticipate what questions you might be asked and try rehearsing them yourself and give them to your friends and make your friends interview you and tell them to be ruthless with you. Take notes after your interview. What do you think went well? What didn't go well? How can you prepare better next time? Second interview with the administrators, and this is my final point, was a little bit more daunting because I walked into a room with two people, the dean of instruction and the president, and they were very quiet. They would ask a question and then just take notes and take notes and take notes, and it was kind of like talking into a canyon. And it was really, really scary. I mean, I started to feel, you know, if you feel like you're talking into a canyon, you begin speaking more rapidly, and you begin looking for the door, and you suddenly really need the bathroom, and you can't go there. So what I finally did at one point in that interview was I started saying, am I being clear, or does this point make sense to you? So that I could get past the nodding head and the shaking head or the smile or the frown. At the time, I thought that I was committing a terrible faux pas by doing that. I now think it was the best thing I could have done, because what it said was, I am modeling for you how you need to communicate with a visually impaired person. You have to be a room that speaks. You have to do it. And you have to find really nice ways of doing this. It took me a few job searches before I got the first one, and I learned from those falls and hard knocks. I think it's really important, and I'll just echo John Davis here, clean up, come in your best condition possible, be groomed, do your homework, do your research. Remember that your interview is a conversation, not an inquisition. Come prepared to converse. I guess that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Susan?
After the interview, we're supposed to still write a follow-up letter?
Yes, absolutely.
And that would you assume from what you're saying that kind of write a reflection if there was anything else you wanted to add from your interview?
You cannot add anything in the follow-up letter because it looks tacky. Okay. What you can do and what you must do the night you get home is to write a letter that says, thank you so much for the opportunity of meeting with you today. I really enjoyed learning from you. This experience was exciting for me. I hope I hear from you in the future. That's it. Because you don't want to, if you do anything else, it looks like you're tacking on, or I meant to say, your time to do it is when you're in that room.
Okay.
Yeah. But the letter is crucial. It's crucial, even if you're going to get rejected. It's the right thing to do.
Well, I don't know about that grading of paper.
In this day and age, is it better to do a written and send it snail mail or an email?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question.
In this day and age, do you think it's better to write the letter and send it, you know, through the postal mail or send an email?
Do both, and I'll tell you why. If you're writing to the people on the committee and you have their email addresses, it's friendly. But you want a written record that goes into hard copy file of what you've done. At least that's how I feel about it. Others may have a different feeling. I think it's really important. And by the way, even though some applications are online, when I was doing my interviews, they were hard copy, and so I had to type them all out and print them all out, and that may still be the case. You do whatever they ask you to do, and you do it with grace.
Tell me more about the demonstration teaching that you had to do. Describe how that worked. Who did you teach? Did you go into a classroom, and did they have students that they set up for that, or staff?
No, you were actually teaching you were actually doing your demonstration for the committee of your peers who were interviewing you. So the people who were there a witness to that demonstration were the members of the English department who were on my committees, the members of student services who were on those committees. They could have been from health, they could have been from EOPS, which is equal opportunity, they could have been from student reentry, and then the student and there were other faculty too. You always have, because community colleges tend to cross disciplines a lot, they'll always have someone from the biology or someone from the math or some other department on your committee, which is really kind of fun. So you are teaching them. And they want to. That's one of the reasons for that is that they want to know how you can address a varied audience, because the students in your classroom are going to be varied too. You're going to have people who are really, really excellent and working way above grade level, and you're going to have people who are struggling just to hang in there. You're going to have people who are in the writing class because God made them, and they'd rather not be there. They'd never not write if they, you know. And you're going to have people who really want to be there. So it's actually a good exercise, even though it's a little bit hair-raising. The whole interview was about an hour and 5 minutes. The teaching demonstration was 20 minutes. The grading of the paper was 10 minutes, as I recall. And they varied each time because each position was a little different. Once it was a critical thinking position. Once I was applying for a position for African American literature, and what they really were hoping to find, and the person they did hire was ultimately an African American candidate who is one of my very best friends. The good news for me was that by applying for that position, I got notified the next year when they had another position. So even though I wasn't hired for that, and any interview you go through is good for you, even the ones that you know screw up. I remember one at San Jose City College, and I suggested that students should record their work, and she said, "Our students can't afford tape recorders. We can't hire you." She did. She said it. So go home. No big deal. The funny thing was that we worked together later on a statewide committee.
Does anybody have any other questions? I find this very fascinating. I really do in both cases. Well, thank you very much. I was thinking there would be more.
Yep, that's fine. Thank you.